From Feature Story News in Washington and our bureaus around the world, this is FSN Reports. I'm Kevin McAleese. On today's programme, illegitimate and unconstitutional. The US condemns the Crimean push to join Russia as Washington announces sanctions against Moscow.
Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine. In 2014, we are well beyond the days when borders can be redrawn over the heads of democratic leaders.
Plus, the UN Security Council pushes for peacekeeping troops to end the bloodshed in the Central African Republic. And we find out if the Republican Party is any closer to finding a presidential candidate for 2016.
I think that all of these speeches have indicated really how divided the Republican Party still is.
That's coming up on FSN Reports after our latest summary of the day's headlines.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Rebecca Foster. President Obama says he will not recognize a proposed referendum in the Crimean Peninsula to determine whether the territory should become part of the Russian Federation. Speaking at the White House shortly after the U.S. imposed sanctions on Moscow, he again accused the Russians of violating international law. Our Washington correspondent Simon Marks reports.
Just hours after unveiling sanctions and a visa ban on Russian leaders, President Obama upped the ante again. He told reporters he won't recognize the proposed referendum on Crimea joining the Russian Federation.
The proposed referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian Constitution and violate international law. Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine.
The president said the door is still open for negotiations with Russia, but he's keeping the pressure on Moscow in a bid to concentrate Vladimir Putin's mind.
Earlier, Crimea's parliament voted to join Russia and to hold a referendum on the 16th of March to ratify the move. Ukraine's interim government says such a vote would be unconstitutional. European Union leaders have agreed to suspend visa talks with Russia and stop preparations for the upcoming G8 summit in response to the Ukrainian crisis. The EU says Russia will face severe consequences, such as asset freezes and travel bans, if it does not de-escalate the situation in the Crimea region. European Council President Herman Van Rompuy says the EU is united in saying it will take further action if Russia does more to destabilize Ukraine.
Today, all leaders affirmed that as European Union, we have a special responsibility for peace, stability and prosperity on our continent. And we are ready to take that responsibility. Acts of aggression cannot be without consequences.
U.S. officials say they are investigating a NATO airstrike, which killed at least five Afghan soldiers in one of the deadliest incidents of friendly fire in the history of the U.S.-led war in Afghanistan. The strike comes a month before a presidential election in Afghanistan, which will see President Karzai's exit at a time of deteriorating relations with the U.S. Nina Maria Potts reports.
Details of the NATO airstrike on Thursday morning are still sketchy. Western officials were quick to apologize, but the incident comes at a time of heightened tensions between the U.S. administration and Afghan President Hamid Karzai. The Afghan leader has long claimed NATO airstrikes are ineffective and cause too many civilian casualties, while the U.S. insists they are critical to the war on terror. Also on Thursday, the brother of Hamid Karzai bowed out of the country's upcoming presidential race and endorsed one of his rivals, shaking up the election campaign a month before the vote.
From bureaus worldwide, this is FSN. Another of the world's biggest companies has indicated it would like Scotland to stay in the UK. The chief executive of oil giant Shell now says the company values the continuity of Britain. This comes ahead of a vote on Scottish independence in September, as Ollie Barrett reports.
Ben van Beurden says he wants Scotland to stay part of the UK and the UK to stay part of the European Union. He says Shell, whose parent company is incorporated in Britain, wants the greater investment stability and certainty provided by the UK remaining one country. The Scottish Government says it can reassure Shell of the stable environment an independent Scotland could provide post the September vote. But the Shell view on independence comes as Lloyds Banking Group and Barclays both cite Scotland's referendum as a potential risk to their businesses. Ollie Barrett, London.
And social media giant Facebook has announced a crackdown on users trying to sell or trade guns on its platform. It follows intense pressure from gun control advocates to rein in the volume of gun-related postings. Our correspondent Rebecca Hume reports.
The new policy comes after more than 225,000 people petitioned Facebook to crack down on illegal sales made via its service. Facebook says its users and those on Instagram under the age of 18 will be blocked altogether from viewing posts about gun sales. And access to gun-related postings will be limited and regulated for all users. The new rules also mean that firearms sellers will have to advertise that they run background checks and won't be able to conduct transactions across state lines without going through a licensed firearms dealer. Rebecca Hume, Washington.
And that's the latest Feature Story News. Rebecca Foster reporting.
From Feature Story News in Washington, I'm Kevin McAleese. Welcome to FSN Reports.
Referendum on the future of Crimea would violate the Ukrainian Constitution and violate international law. Any discussion about the future of Ukraine must include the legitimate government of Ukraine. In 2014, we are well beyond the days when borders can be redrawn over the heads of democratic leaders.
President Obama's comments at the White House earlier echoed the position of the current Ukrainian government, which dismissed the vote scheduled for March 16th as illegitimate and unconstitutional. Barack Obama has already ordered the freezing of the US assets and a ban on travel to the United States for a number of unnamed Ukrainian and Russian officials. However, it's thought President Vladimir Putin was not on the list. EU members also met today and reacted to Moscow's moves by suspending visa and economic talks with Russia, while threatening tougher sanctions could follow. For more on the reaction on Crimea's push to join Russia and the international response, I spoke to our correspondent in Moscow, Dan Whitehead.
Well, it is difficult to judge the impact on the basis that the executive order issued by President Barack Obama is so wide-ranging and flexible that it could have a greater impact than expected. Visa bans and sanctions on what will likely be government officials and other wealthy Russians, those that the US says are responsible for activities which undermine the democratic process in Ukraine, that will inconvenience Russia, of course, but it won't greatly impact on the country or its economy. However, Russian stocks have fallen again on that news, and that will, of course, be on Vladimir Putin's radar. We have heard from a number of foreign minister spokespeople about the sanctions announced from America. Alexander Lukashevich accusing Obama of a primitive distortion of reality, undisguised double standards. Another foreign ministry spokesman did issue a statement in regards to the possibility that the EU will temporarily suspend talks with Russia about more liberal visa issuances, saying that it is complete absurdity, politicised and unconstructive. So there's no doubt that sanctions are rattling Russia.
So Crimea looks set to hold a referendum, a vote on whether or not to join Russia, the Russian Federation. The Ukrainian Prime Minister dismissed that as illegitimate. What was the reaction of Moscow to this announcement?
It is hard to see how the Kremlin would not be pleased with this outcome. It says that it is aware of the situation. It hasn't issued an official statement. Sergei Mironov, the leader of the Fair Russia Party, says that the bill to start the process of allowing Crimea to become part of the Russian Federation will be debated on Tuesday. So the Russian government certainly moving quickly on this. But of course, they will face a very tough battle. Ukraine's interim prime minister, Arseniy Yatsenyuk, gave that impassioned speech saying the decision to hold a referendum is illegitimate. He insists Crimea is and will continue to be an integral part of Ukraine and that the referendum has no legal basis. So Vladimir Putin and the Russian government have got that to fight against. This vote's clearly not going to be the end of the story. So on top of that, sanctions and diplomatic turmoil, it means Crimea's future is far from certain.
Dan Whitehead in Moscow. The EU has joined the US in outlining steps it could take against Russia over its military action in Ukraine. And to discuss the response hammered out by EU member states, I spoke to our Brussels correspondent, Sanja Gatman.
Well, the first course of action involves an immediate suspension of talks between the European Union and Russia on agreeing to a visa-free travel deal, which both sides were very excited about as it would really boost economic ties between the two blocs with much more free movement involved. That has been frozen effective immediately in response to Moscow's actions up until now. Now, the effort subsequently is going to concentrate on building a contact or so-called cooperation body that's going to be in Ukraine involving officials from Moscow in trying to reach a political solution for the country, taking into account some of Russia's concerns about minority rights in Ukraine. If Moscow fails to cooperate in being part of this framework and building this in the next few days, then the EU has said it's going to explicitly consider travel bans and asset freezes on Russian officials. And it's the first time the EU has, in fact, delineated those specific consequences for Moscow. Now, the other more serious consequence for Russia is if there are steps taken by its military to escalate the situation, if it makes military advances, and that will involve other sanctions, including trade and financial restrictions, that the European Union was hesitant to explicitly include in its communique today, but has been pushed to in response to many countries saying that Moscow needs to really be pushed against a wall in order to cooperate politically.
Sandra, was there a united front from the gathered EU members for this push for sanctions against Russia?
Well, there was some consensus about wanting to send a clear message to Russia about facing consequences for breaching international laws and encroaching on another country's territory, as well as a broad outcry about the recent Crimean referendum that all leaders here in Brussels agree was illegal. But at the same time, there were broad divisions surrounding what kind of sanctions should be imposed on Moscow and when, obviously with different European nations having varying economic relationships with Russia. Germany is very dependent on Moscow's gas supply, for instance. Britain, according to a leaked document this week, is very concerned, quietly concerned, about driving away Russian investment in the city of London. So many countries feeling that these last resort trade or financial restrictions against Moscow this early on would be a mistake. It would be shooting themselves in the foot economically, as well as aggravating the situation and provoking Moscow, perhaps, because both the EU and Russia rely on each other. Now, at the same time, we had a group of Baltic countries, Poland as well, being very worried about the lack of signs from Russia of any kind of de-escalation so far, and they wanted very much to put real threats out there to incentivize Russian cooperation. And that said, all efforts right now, though, are on diplomatic efforts, and they want to see Moscow involved in a political solution.
And finally, Sandra, there's been a suggestion that Washington's decision to impose sanctions inspired EU leaders to toughen their stance. Is there any truth in that?
Well, we've been watching the rumor mill today, and several diplomats have said this was the case. And indeed, it seems that during the course of the day, we can observe that there was a change in the draft conclusions from this meeting of EU leaders. From this morning being very vague and failing to express any kind of specific measures that could be taken against Russia should it not cooperate, to finally including specific references to things like travel bans and asset freezes in its final conclusions being communicated this evening. Now, German Chancellor Angela Merkel responded to a journalist's question asking whether the U.S.'s decision to delineate these sanctions actually inspired European action. She said that Washington and Brussels have always been in close contact. They've cooperated on a reaction to Russia, but I think it's safe to say that the story and events on the ground in Ukraine are developing so fast that the EU was compelled to stand in solidarity with the US, and they've now mentioned explicit consequences for Russia.
Sandra Gatman in Brussels. Today, the lower chamber of the US Congress passed a bill to provide $1 billion in loan guarantees to the newly formed government in Ukraine. Supporters said such aid would protect the struggling country from possible economic retaliation from neighbouring Russia and called for Congress to take even stronger steps in the coming days, such as passing sanctions against Russia and calling for their permanent removal from the G8. Other lawmakers said Congress should support the International Monetary Fund in bailing out the Ukrainian government and help them with economic reforms. But some are raising concerns about what impact these reforms would have on the Ukrainian people. On Capitol Hill, Alice Olstein reports.
Democrats and Republicans joined together Thursday to pass a rapidly drafted bill to loan about $1 billion to the Ukraine. New York Democrat Brian Higgins spoke to FSN minutes before the vote about the importance of the measure.
I mean, the loan guarantee is being offered to Ukraine to help it because, you know, Russia is in a position to exert some economic pain on Ukraine. So, you know, we have to ensure that we're there to pick up the pieces so that the Ukrainian people are not hurt by this.
Higgins is one of many lawmakers calling for additional actions from the U.S. government, both on its own and in coordination with the many international bodies where it wields great influence.
The G8 should revoke the membership of Russia because they clearly violated the tenets that gave them acceptance in the first place. They're causing trouble. That's Putin's history. He likes to be both troublemaker and peacemaker. And NATO, which, you know, has its 28 countries, including the United States and Canada, 26 European countries, seeks to protect one another because they share the same values, should embrace the membership of Ukraine. And I think these are things the United States should look at in addition to economic sanctions.
On Thursday morning, Higgins and his colleagues on the House Foreign Affairs Committee discussed some of these moves with officials from the State Department, the Treasury Department, and USAID. Committee Chair Ed Royce said he's preparing a bill to impose crippling sanctions on Russian high-ranking officials, state-owned banks, and businesses, and key individuals behind what he called the Russian intervention. Royce also stressed a mandate from the International Monetary Fund that any financial aid from the U.S. or world community is conditioned on the Ukraine making major reforms to its economy.
This help must be accompanied by fundamental economic reforms if Ukraine is to stabilize its economy. Only Ukraine can help us help them.
The term economic reforms came up again and again at Thursday's hearing, but there was little talk of what those reforms will be. Current Ukrainian leader Yatsenyuk has said they could include the privatization of parts of the national oil and gas sector, deep cuts to pensions, raising public transit fares and gas prices, and slashing subsidies for household heat and electricity. California Democrat Karen Bass was the only lawmaker to question how these changes would impact people on the ground. Treasury Department official Dalip Singh assured her that the reforms are good for the Ukraine.
There has been an unsustainable buildup in fiscal spending over the years in Ukraine. That needs to be addressed. Number two, there are truly massive energy subsidies that have been a part that have played.
Subsidies to companies or subsidies to the population?
To the population, to tariffs that are paid for heating and gas and so forth. And that's led to a consumption of energy that's among the highest in the region.
Would you be concerned that some of the reforms might cause problems, dissent, if subsidies are cut off? You know what I mean?
So that's why our notion on the loan guarantee is to try to direct the proceeds of that issuance, it's a bond issuance that we have in mind, and direct that towards the more vulnerable segments of the Ukrainian society so that those reforms are easier to implement and that they don't fall on those who can least afford to bear them.
Other committee members said the best way to support the Ukraine is to increase fracking of natural gas in the United States and export it to replace the supply the country currently gets from Russia. Some even demanded the president approve the controversial Keystone XL pipeline to further increase fossil fuel production and export. But environmentalists in Congress, including Arizona Democrat Raul Grijalva, called this effort inane and desperate and vowed to oppose it.
Here we were talking about energy independence. Never has this been the issue. It's used as a ploy to try to talk to the American people that this will make us energy secure. The XL pipeline is about exportation, and now the cat's out of the bag in the fact that natural gas development in this country needs to be for exportation. It's always been the agenda. It's never been about energy independence. It's never been about renewables or alternatives. It's always been about exportation and how to make money off of it.
In a surprise address Thursday afternoon, President Obama praised Congress's steps to pass loan packages for the Ukraine and called on them to quickly pass additional legislation supporting the International Monetary Fund's efforts, saying it's time to turn words into actions. In Washington, I'm Alice Holstein.
This is FSN Reports. The United Nations Security Council is considering a UN proposal for a nearly 12,000-strong peacekeeping force to stop the Central African Republic from sliding toward what human rights groups have called ethnic religious cleansing. Thousands have been killed in sectarian violence following last year's coup. If approved, the UN force would be comprised of both troops and police, but is unlikely to be operational before late summer. To find out what was discussed by the Security Council today, I spoke to FSN's Nick Harper at the UN headquarters in New York.
Well, essentially, this was an impassioned plea by some top UN officials. We heard from the head of peacekeeping, the head of refugees, and the head of humanitarian affairs, all of them saying that things need to change. Valerie Amos, who is the head of humanitarian affairs, said that action by the Security Council was required to prevent further bloodshed. And effectively, it was an opportunity for the Security Council to hear the recommendations being made by Ban Ki-moon, the Secretary General, that the Central African Republic now needs a full peacekeeping force. That's something that they don't currently have. But Ban Ki-moon thinks that 12,000 peacekeepers need to go to the country. That would be made up of 10,000 troops and 2,000 police, and he thinks that is needed very soon to stop what has been called this morning the vicious circle of retaliation between Christians and Muslims. These ethnic killings that are being warned from the United Nations officials are at risk of genocide. However, even with the peacekeepers in the country, the head of peacekeeping operations, Hervé Ladsous, said it wasn't going to be easy.
Let us be clear, there will be no quick fix in the Central African Republic. Responding to the crisis will require time, it will require resources. The scale of the needs in the Central African Republic is daunting.
We've heard talk of sending a full peacekeeping force for months now to the Central African Republic. How likely is that to happen, and what's the timeline?
Well, yes, Ban Ki-moon made recommendations back in November for a peacekeeping force. After that, in December, the Security Council didn't decide to do that, but they did decide to send French troops out to help the African Union troops. And at the end of January, some European Union troops were sent. Effectively, the Security Council has been holding off sending a full peacekeeping unit. One of the big worries is the cost. The United States are against it because they pay about a fourth of the UN peacekeeping budget. And the cost of this mission alone would be around $500 to $800 million a year. The timescale on this would also take several months to complete. However, the head of humanitarian affairs, Valerie Amos, told the Security Council extra resources were desperately required.
More troops are desperately needed, and they are needed now. Central Africans need to feel safe in their own country. It is the first vital step for recovery. And the international community appears paralysed.
So obviously the Security Council needs to consider the Secretary General's recommendations for a full peacekeeping force and then vote on it. But when do we think that vote is likely to happen?
Well, at the moment, we're hearing the vote may not happen for a few more weeks, potentially towards the end of the month. And even if they approve a full peacekeeping force, there is still a long road ahead. Ban Ki-moon has already said that it would be 6 months before any of those peacekeepers are on the ground. So a very long road ahead, and there's still no guarantee that a full peacekeeping force will be sent.
Nick Harper at the UN headquarters in New York. Now, today saw the start of the Conservative Political Action Conference, CPAC, in Washington, D.C. The three-day event will hear speeches from party leaders and plenty of discussion on the future direction of the GOP. New Jersey Governor Chris Christie, snubbed for last year's get-together, gave his highly anticipated appearance on Thursday. And earlier I spoke to Jessica Taylor, campaign editor for TheHill.com, and began by asking her if the Republican Party were any closer to finding their 2016 presidential candidate.
Not really. I mean, I think that all of these speeches have indicated really how divided the Republican Party still is. But also I'd say that it's still a long way away from 2016 or when these nominating conventions really begin in earnest. I mean, we're not going to see anyone really fully declare until after the midterms this year. And you know, we've seen a host of likely probable presidential candidates come across there. We had Ted Cruz open the convention this morning, Paul Ryan, Chris Christie's trying to sort of salvage his presidential hopes. We'll hear from a lot more tomorrow, including Rand Paul, Rick Perry, Rick Santorum. So this really is sort of one of the first cattle calls of the event, but they have a long way to go before they have settled on a front runner, and that really may not happen even once we get into the Republican presidential process.
You mentioned Chris Christie, very much the filling in the sandwich, if you like, in the running order of the speeches we heard today. How did the New Jersey governor, how was he received at this event? This was highly anticipated. And where do you think this leaves his standing in the party?
He was actually received fairly well for being, he was pointedly left off last year of the invite list after sort of embracing President Obama right before the election in the wake of Hurricane Sandy to help his state. But he's especially been trying to sort of recover his political career in the wake of the bridge scandal. But he came in, he talked about mainly his role as head of the Republican Governors Association, how governors were sort of on the forefront of some of these fights. And really, he threw a lot of red meat out there, and the crowd really ate it up. I think that they were almost more sympathetic to him. They saw him as sort of being attacked in the media by some of these allegations, and especially in some more of the liberal progressive media. So I think that he really did get a largely warm reception. I think he certainly did what he needed to do with an audience that he's not as necessarily familiar with to at least repair some bridges.
Jessica, in your role as campaign editor for TheHill.com, what did you make of the gathering as a whole? And what do you think it tells us about the soul of the GOP, the battle between the more liberal and the more hardline ultra-conservative mm-hmm. wings of the party?
Well, we got a sort of a smattering of both sides today. Ted Cruz, of course, sort of the hero of the Tea Party hero, and has really blamed a lot for the government shutdown last year. He sort of kicked off the convention this morning, and he really didn't back away from a lot of the things he talked about with repealing Obamacare. And a lot of these people, one of the things I was most surprised by is they really were starting to talk about Ukraine and President Obama's foreign policy as we are sort of in this very tenuous situation with Russia. They see it as certainly another opportunity to hit him on being an ineffective president. We've heard that from almost all of the speakers, so I think we probably would have heard a little bit more on health care, but right now this certainly gives them another opportunity to attack him on foreign policy.
Jessica Taylor, campaign editor with TheHill.com. And that's the Thursday edition of FSN Reports. You can contact us about the programme by emailing us reports@featurestory.com. That's reports@featurestory.com. And look for us on Twitter. We're there @featurestory. Coming up on Friday, we're in South Africa for a roundup of week one of the murder trial of Oscar Pistorius. That's Friday, but for now, I'm Kevin McAleese in Washington alongside producer Simon Marks and Rebecca Foster on the Bulletin Desk. For everyone, with Feature Story News everywhere, have a great evening. Goodbye.